Hello and welcome to Parking Thought, the show where we highlight the good in the world, from the extraordinary to the everyday. You're going to want to like and subscribe wherever you happen to find us. Curiosity, meet gratitude. My name is Jacob, and I'm glad you're here today. In this edition, we're going to be talking about government. Again, yes, we're going to be talking about the government. This week's theme for the show is to talk about the government and politics and try to do it in a way where we can still walk away and be happy, even if we find things that we don't necessarily agree with. It's actually not hard to transition from something that you hear that doesn't quite make sense to you or doesn't feel right to you into still being grateful for what you do have. And I think you guys will see that through this episode today. And if you don't, or if you do, you're welcome to leave a comment wherever you happen to find us. In fact, one of the great places to leave comments is over on YouTube. But enough of me plugging things. Let's talk about the show's topic. So the show's topic today is on how governments like to think of themselves as permanent. They like to create a sense of permanence. They like to use rhetoric around being permanently there and being permanently able to provide things. And this is good in many respects. This is really good in a lot of respects. So having the government create laws that are stable and predictable and able for us to build other systems on top of is a really good thing. Like, we need that in society. There's a great example on YouTube and about how YouTube is enforcing something about copyright, but that's different than the actual copyright law, right? And so that totally makes sense, right? The law exists to protect copyright, and YouTube has their own policy to make sure that they reduce their legal risk when it comes to copyright claims and protections and other things like that. And so the law creates that foundational structure, and then YouTube is able to build on top of that. And so if that law were to constantly change or be in flux, or the interpretation was constantly changing or being in flux, it would make it difficult for YouTube to manage, you know, their interpretation of it, which, by the way, costs them quite a bit of money to be able to grow and develop and implement. And whether we like the way it's constructed or not, the law functions in those ways. The law functions as a foundation, and it needs to do that. But what's also kind of interesting is sometimes our laws are created to respond to something specifically that may or may not actually be a permanent issue. And we see this in two areas, right? Well, we see this in lots of areas, but there are two I want to talk about on the show today. And one of them is the Johnstown flood. Now, if you've never heard of the Johnstown flood, Johnstown was in Pennsylvania, right? And what happened is the dam that was near the town, right? The dam that was above the town broke. There's lots of stories about how and why and blah, 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 all that other stuff. But the dam broke, partially due to some man-made interpretation or man-made interference. And then, you know, that city or that town was just kind of wiped away, right? And lots of people died. What's interesting, though, is the Johnstown flood tax that the government enacted to provide relief for the Johnstown flood victims, right, was enacted in 1936, and it's still on the books as of 2017, right? So none of the victims of the flood are still alive anymore, but the tax is still being collected in Pennsylvania. It's still being put into the treasury. And it's easy to understand how things like this happen, because the tax, regardless of its justification, right, it's a revenue source. And if it goes into the general fund so it can get spent anywhere within the state, then it just kind of exists and it's a good thing. And the government's able to say, look, we do good things with this revenue. But at some point, people might start noticing that they're paying for victims who have passed away because they've lived out their natural lives. And we can see here that the government's ability to create something that's permanent or near permanent or feels like it's permanent, you know, can tend to live past its usefulness. And I would like to argue that the Food and Drug Administration is also one of these entities that exists out there. So the Food and Drug Administration was also created in the early 20th century, and it's done a lot of good. Nothing I'm about to say takes away the good that it does. but it was based on a scientific model that doesn't exactly hold water, at least not exclusively in our modern day. And what I mean by that is the FDA was created as a response for food and other materials that people were consuming being able to cause harm. So like, let's say there's like Joe's Beans, right? And Joe's Beans' manufacturing process, the manufacturing process at the factory for Joe's Beans, didn't exactly use best practices, and parts of the machinery would end up in the food. People could get sick, and that would be an issue. So the FDA was created in response to things like this, right? Now, what's also interesting is at the time they were created, in the early 20th century, and our understanding of medicine at the time, I mean, this is before, you know, heart bypass surgery. This is before the war on cancer. This is before and right about the time where we really started understanding bacteria and viruses and drugs and other things like that, and things that harmed us, and washing our hands and coughing in your elbow, before a lot of those things had happened. Well, one of the things here that the FDA was chartered with is the FDA was chartered with reviewing future medicines so that way 51% of the tested population would have a positive result. So what does that mean? That means that if I have a drug that's going to restore my hair, right, I need to make sure that when I test that on the given population, that 51% of them have a positive result. And if that's the only science you have, that is a scientifically sound way of being able to test that hair restoration drug, right? Now, that's not the only way we can test things scientifically now. I mean, in recent years, we've been able to map the human genome, which means that there are drugs, there are chemicals out there, and they can be applied to certain people who will have a more positive result. But if those people don't make up 51% of the tested population, it can never get to market. And so let's put this in a really extreme scenario. I'm terminally ill. I'm actually not, but let's pretend for a moment that me or you or one of your loved ones is terminally ill, and that there is a medicine out there that could potentially extend their life or increase the comfort of the rest of the life that they have left, right? But because the tested population was only 30%, the drug never made it to market. And this actually happens. Now, what would happen otherwise if we said, okay, well, we're going to test people of a certain genetic makeup who and their ability to have a positive result to this drug. And let's say you're one of those people, or your loved one is one of those people that has a 90% or 80% or 70% chance of having a better quality of life because of this drug being on the market, right? Because of their genetic makeup. If you did it based upon genetic makeup, you actually have the chance to have a more diverse market as far as medicine goes, and to be able to have more people be treated for more things and increase their comfort overall in life. And isn't that kind of what we're after? Now, the FDA's 51% model isn't bad. It's gotten us so far, right? But that doesn't mean it's the model that we should apply going forward. Also, the FDA as a government body and the way it's constructed and a few other things, the people who have to make the decision about green lighting a drug for market, right, really have a lot of skin in the game. They have a lot of their neck on the line. They can have a lot of negative repercussions. There are strong social and systematic, you know, discouragements from saying yes to releasing new drugs on the market that we really don't know what we're missing. And it is one of the reasons why drug companies spend so much time, so much money, and charge us so much money for the drugs. It's not just the R&D, it's the years and years of process to get through the FDA using 100-year-old interpretations of the scientific method before we can actually even get to the part where it might help improve and increase your quality of life. That is a bit of a tragedy. And so what I suggest, what I recommend as a solution, as an alternative to this, is purely market-based, you know, reviews. Let the FDA's model exist, right? But let some other company do it. Use the 51%. It's still scientifically sound. It's just not the only scientific, you know, method that we can provide. Let that exist. Let somebody like Consumer Reports do that. And let insurance companies and doctors subscribe like they would to Consumer Reports to that subscription service that has all of those drug records. And since we've been paying as the public for the FDA, all of their existing trials, research, and all the write-ups on that should be easily available by any company company wants to run a drug review service. And so while Consumer Reports, let's say for this example, may choose to follow the FDA model of 51%, and that is definitely a good scientific way, because remember, it's gotten us quite a bit far. We could have another company, you know, 23andMe might look at this as a potential market, and they might look at all the information they have on genetic, makeup and people and how they respond to different drugs. And they might say, okay, well, 23andMe is going to have a subscription service that people can subscribe to, or insurance companies and doctors could subscribe to, that talks about how each of these drugs would respond to people with different genetic makeup. And wow, wouldn't that be a great market, right? And then Ancestry, who also has a lot of genetic information, you know, from people sending in their genetic code, right? To be able to use that as well. And now all of a sudden, you went from having the FDA being the sole source of truth to having three competitors in the market who doctors can use and consult with you and say, well, you know, based on this trial with the FDA, you know, or excuse me, it wouldn't be the FDA at that point, but this trial with Consumer Reports and this trial with Ancestry and this trial with 23andMe, I'm going to prescribe X and you're going to have XYZ percentage likely to have an improved quality of life because of this drug. Wow. Wouldn't that be cool? And no political candidate. I am recording this either slightly after or during the presidential debates. There's not a single one of those presidential candidates who is arguing for the FDA to phase out and be replaced by a market-based solution. Not a single one of them. Not a single one of them. In fact, when you watch them, it's almost as if America is on the edge of a catastrophic failure and life is going to end for everyone unless a certain person ends up sitting in the White House in Washington, D.C. And that's absolutely not the case. The world is so much better than we realize. I may currently disagree with the way the FDA is constructed. I may want them to change. I may want them to not be there. I may want them to be a market-based solution. And it's okay that we're not there yet. Because if we look at where we are compared to 100 years ago, remember, 100 years ago, they were dealing with a different flu epidemic. It wasn't the coronavirus, right? It was the Spanish influenza, and it killed thousands of people a day. It killed a significant percentage of the world's population. We are better off because the FDA has existed and because it has allowed us to be able to have safe medicines to consume. And I will not take that away from the FDA. Nor will I ever take away something good that anybody else does, whether they're a president I disagree with or a political candidate I disagree with. There are things where we do agree, and I think we need to look for those. So again, I'm more of a libertarian at heart. I know where I'd like to be as a country with market-based solutions, solving problems in a free enterprise sort of system, you know, where the government has laws, but they're predictable, limited, and easy for people to understand. And I know that's not where we are right now, but that doesn't stop me from loving my family, loving the fact that I can make a podcast, sharing the time with you guys, and all of the other great things that happen out there in the world. And with that, let's end this episode. Let's wrap this up. Now, if you just joined us for this episode because the title was catchy or something else got you here, we're really glad to have you. Now, the best way you can say thank you for this episode is to share it with somebody else you know, and maybe that's how you came across it. Now, if you want to stick around for the long haul because you like a little dose of gratitude in your day, right, go ahead and hit the subscribe links over at parkingthought.com or wherever you happen to find us, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, you know, Pocket Casts, all of those things, you can find us out there. If you want to really do us a favor right now, hit us up on the YouTube. We could definitely use some more subscribers there. And that's also a great platform to engage us at. If you want to engage us otherwise outside of YouTube, hit us up on Twitter. We are at Parking Thought. Now, I like to finish every episode, not just saying thank you for you guys, but with a challenge to remember that in a world where we can choose to be anything, why not choose to be grateful?